This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday afternoon, December 5th, 2019, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. It's 6 minutes after 12. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Ahead this hour, advanced energy in Arkansas. On this week's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report, a look back at how Arkansas residents, businesses, and cities have approached energy in 2019. After our show on Here and Now, cities across the country are dealing with a housing affordability crisis, and it's forcing some in the Mountain West to make difficult choices. A closer look at the issue on Here and Now, beginning at 1 on 91.3 KUAF. And Saturday, the new season of the Met Opera begins on KUAF 2, the Metropolitan Opera, live beginning this Saturday at noon on KUAF 2. To hear KUAF 2 on your smart speaker, just say play KUAF 2. KUAF 2 also available at KUAF.com and on your HD radio. The Arkansas Department of Transportation will hold a public meeting this afternoon and tonight in Rogers to discuss the proposed highway connection between Northwest Arkansas Regional Airport and the Springdale Northern Bypass, also known as Highway 612. The drop-in event is from 4 to 7 at Trinity Grace Church on Bellevue Road in Rogers. And the UAFS volleyball team opens play in the NCAA Division II National Tournament this evening at 6 in Colorado, facing Texas A&M Commerce, winner advancing to the next round, which is played tomorrow. This is Ozarks at Large. In late November, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resource Conservation Service and Animal and Plant Health and Inspection Service announced awards to fund 20 pilot projects across 10 southern states to control the spread of destructive feral swine. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service awarded a total of $16.7 million for feral swine control projects in Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas, states where invasive destructive feral swine are most concentrated. Of the 10 states, Arkansas was awarded the most money, $3.4 million. Helen Denniston is state resource conservationist for USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is collaborating with the Arkansas Natural Resource Commission to blunt feral swine destruction across the state.
We know it is in the millions of dollars. Generally, the damage is occurring in pasture landfills. They're also harming cropland fields. They just overrun an area.
Feral swine, which wallow and root for earthworms, grubs, insects, and fish, destroy farmland, forests, and waterways, killing domestic livestock and wildlife, threatening certain endangered species. Feral hogs also carry infectious diseases and parasites introduced to North America by European settlers. Non-native Eurasian wild boars continue to spread across the southeastern U.S., as well as California, released into the wild by sport hunters, causing $1.5 billion in damage annually. To stop their spread, nearly 70% of hog populations have to be exterminated, with remnant herds intensely controlled.
That is correct, yeah. Generally the states, the southeast, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, we're looking at the Carolinas also have a terrible problem. Texas, it is definitely seems to be centered in this particular area.
Wild sows can produce several litters of piglets per season, which quickly mature and reproduce. Hunting wild hogs only scatters herds, experts say, and poisoning can cause collateral damage to other wildlife. But this pilot project is testing strategic trapping.
This is not a sprint, it's a marathon.
James Baker, a state biologist with USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, says the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission applied to the grant pilot project along with 9 other states.
States where feral swine are a persistent problem, we approached headquarters with an idea of putting together a pilot program to see how effective some of this newer technology was?
The USDA NRCS Feral Swine Eradication and Control Pilot Program was established under the 2018 Farm Bill to respond to the burgeoning threat feral swine pose. Total funding for the program is $75 million. Pilot projects consist of feral swine removal, land restoration, and assistance for feral swine control partnership agreements with non-federal partners. Projects can last 1 to 3 years. In Arkansas, two tiers of four pilot projects will take place across 22 counties in four ecoregions. On the Ozarks, that includes Boone, Marion, Baxter, Izard, Searcy, and Fulton counties. Sebastian, Logan, Yell, Pope, and Scott counties in the western Arkansas River Valley, and a dozen counties in southeastern and southwestern Arkansas.
So feral swine are difficult to show success with. So we knew that if we went to the most infested counties in the state, that we would have limited success. And so, therefore, we chose some of the Ozark counties and some of the South Arkansas counties that didn't have quite as bad of a hog problem. Probably the worst county in the state is Lafayette County.
The project involves installation of large state-of-the-art baited and monitored corral traps.
Because they're very smart, they're a different sort of animal from a trapping standpoint. So what we have now is, with the camera technology, we have virtually everywhere in the state where we can get cell phone signal, and we can get real-time streaming camera data. So we'll set up a trap. We'll get pigs on bait. When we get them on bait, then we'll set up a trap, and we'll set up a camera watching the trap with the gates open. And the trapper is able to actually see in real time what's going on at the trap without having to be there. And then he can wait until all of the hogs are in the trap. We've been watching them, doing surveillance on them with these cameras for a week or two. So we know how many pigs are in that group. The group of pigs is called a sounder, and we can wait until we get all of the pigs in that particular sounder in the trap before we drop the gate. And this has proven to be very effective technology in removing feral swine.
Captured swine are shot, buried, or left for wild carrion to consume.
Part of the money for this is to hire, in each of the Tier 1 counties, is to hire a dedicated trapper. That person, and there's people around the state that are familiar with our technology and are really good trappers, but it's imperative that you have full-time people who do nothing but feral swine control.
The pilot project also has an educational component, Baker says.
There's a plan to hire a statewide feral swine coordinator, and that'll be part of that job's responsibility for education and outreach.
The pilot program will also address feral swine sport hunting.
So one of the things that we've tried to do is disincentivize wild pigs entirely.
Helen Denniston says the USDA NRCS Feral Swine Eradication and Control Pilot Program grant is building upon ongoing collaborative multi-agency feral swine control efforts.
So we're very fortunate to have great partnerships here in Arkansas that we're all working for a common goal, which is not the case in a lot of states.
Denniston says the grant award budget and work plan will take 3 months to finalize before funding is distributed to Arkansas Natural Resources Commission, which is providing a match. ARNC will then hire a project coordinator to implement the program. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Still to come on this Ozarks at Large, the effects of having schools with widely different student populations. Erica Wilson, Thomas Willis Lambeth Distinguished Chair in Public Policy at the University of North Carolina, recently spoke on the University of Arkansas Law School campus as a visiting scholar. She'll discuss here research into schools and their student populations and the effects on society when segregation still exists. That's ahead on today's Ozarks. Big thank yous to everyone who helped make last night's Ozarks at Large Christmas show at the Fayetteville Public Library such a fun time. Thank you to the St. Paul's Episcopal Church Children's Choir, John Henry and Dandelion Heart for providing music. Thank you to the crew at the Fayetteville Public Library and Becca Martin Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette for her reading of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And thank you to all of you who came out to have holiday fun with us live. If you couldn't make it, don't fret. Highlights of this year's show heard right here on Ozarks at Large on Christmas Eve at noon and 7 on 91.3.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Single Parent Scholarship Fund of NWA empowers families in Carroll, Madison, and Washington counties to become financially independent by earning a degree or certificate. The success of hundreds of families has been made possible through the Single Parent Scholarship Fund. Single Parent Scholarship Fund, NWA.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. Small business owners and entrepreneurs who may not qualify for a traditional bank loan will now have another way of accessing capital to grow. Yesterday, Startup Junkie announced the launch of a local Kiva Hub. Kiva is an international crowdsourcing loan platform. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek tells us how it works.
Before she became an executive business consultant for Startup Junkie Foundation, Martha Londigan worked as a small business banker with Legacy National Bank in Springdale.
As everyone knows, banking regulations after the crash in 2008 became very stringent, not just on banks in Northwest Arkansas, but nationally. So banks, because of bank examiners, bank requirements, they have very strict standards. And so even if a local banker knows someone is a great business owner, is doing a great job, and has an excellent potential for their business, if they have a certain low credit score, if they don't have appropriate capital, if there are other issues and documentation that they can't come up with, their hands are tied to make the loan.
That's where the Northwest Arkansas Kiva Hub comes in. Londigan says it can provide entrepreneurs who don't meet the qualifications for a traditional bank loan with another way of getting the capital they need to either expand or launch their businesses.
What makes it exciting is, one, 0% interest, no fees, and the fact that our borrowers in Northwest Arkansas not only will have our community in Washington and Benton County and not only the Walton Family Foundation supporting them, but access to $1.8 million lenders worldwide who can see their profile and say, I like this person. That's an awesome business. I want to help this person.
Kiva is an international nonprofit based out of San Francisco that connects entrepreneurs and small business owners with local lenders. Londigan says the Northwest Arkansas Hub aims to encourage the community to lend money to locals who are running small operations in the region.
I think it also gets our Northwest Arkansas community familiar with building the entrepreneur ecosystem. And part of the total ecosystem is not just banks and borrowers and businesses, it's the community.
Londigan says Startup Junkie's goal over the next 3 years is to use Kiva to fund 20 small businesses or entrepreneurs and to get 4,000 people or groups in Northwest Arkansas to give a loan through Kiva.
I always say to people, small businesses are why we live here. They may not be why we work here, even though small businesses in Arkansas employ 47% of all people in the private sector, but what they bring us, the shops, the food, the entertainment, that's why we want to live here. So we need to support that ecosystem if we want to keep having this wonderful lifestyle we have here.
Kiva borrowers can access up to $10,000 in loans, and lenders can contribute loans as small as $25. Once a borrower applies and is approved, Londigan says they will have 15 days to raise a small portion of their total ask through loans specifically from their community.
So, for example, if they're only asking for $2,000, they're only going to probably have to get five during the private lending period. So once five people have loaned them $25, that's their community vouching for them. That replaces the credit score requirement. That replaces the collateral pledge.
After that, the borrower and their business will be displayed on the international Kiva website, which means their profile can be seen by 1.8 million potential lenders from around the world. Londigan says the borrowers who make it to that point will also be eligible for a dollar-for-dollar match from a $100,000 Walton Family Foundation fund aimed at Benton and Washington County-based businesses.
And that will go on for 3 years until that $100,000 runs out. So we really want to get a lot of people in early and start, using that grant.
With a physical hub in Northwest Arkansas, Londigan says Startup Junkie will be able to help borrowers with applications for Kiva loans and everything that comes after that. Starting next year, the organization will hold training sessions in Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Bentonville, West Fork, Elkins, and Siloam Springs.
So we're going to be there to help them with any of the challenges challenges or any questions they have, just to make it personal. Plus, they're going to connect with Startup Junkie, and we can help them with their business regardless.
Londigan hopes the Kiva Hub will specifically attract underserved entrepreneurs and small business owners who have historically had more difficulty gaining access to capital.
If you are African American, if you are Hispanic Latino, if you are a woman, if you are a person who is of low income, we want you to apply.
Devin Howland, Fayetteville's Director of Economic Vitality, says the city shares that vision and sees the Kiva Hub as one of the ways that policies and funds can be used to back up the region's principles.
You know, this incredible growth that Northwest Arkansas is seeing, this incredible growth that Fayetteville is seeing, that it's actually raising all boats. And to do that is going to be, you have to be wildly intentional about what you want to improve, which talks about measuring what you want to improve. And, you know, you start getting into some of these metrics, whether it be unemployment rate or per capita income by various segments of the population, and it gets uncomfortable. But when you get into those uncomfortable situations, that tells you something. It tells you that's the problem you need to work on fixing.
Meanwhile, in Bentonville, the Chamber of Commerce recently launched a year-long series of workshops focused on diversity and inclusion in entrepreneurship. Jordan Carlisle, who is the Vice President of Economic Development for the Chamber, says they're collaborating with an organization called Venture Noir on that effort.
Which is a venture studio that focuses on helping founders of color scale their businesses. If we look at some of the target demographics, I think we'll find that those founders of color are living in some of the communities that Kiva will be focusing on. I definitely think there's a lot of potential to collaborate and bridging the gap between those two programs and seeing how they can actually work hand in hand with each other.
And Carlisle adds, a crowdsourcing platform like Kiva has the added benefit of building in an audience when a local business has local lenders invested in its success.
When that person takes financial interest in what you're doing, they're also more likely to become a customer. And so if we can help bridge the gap for the lending community and the small business community, we're also building bridges for that business gaining traction with customers.
All this, Devin Howland says, is good for cities because small businesses drive the vast majority of job growth.
And when we do those metrics, we know there's about 4,000, probably a little bit more active businesses in this city. And when we bust that out by FTE count, full-time employee count, we see very blatantly clear that the vast majority of those businesses in here are small businesses.
And Martha Londigan says the Kiva Hub is good for local banks too.
We are going to walk people through rebuilding their business credit. And then Startup Junkie is going to work with them about having profit loss statements and balance sheets and how to have a real legitimate set of books. And then we have Forge in Huntsville. We have Communities Unlimited, which is a regional micro lender with the Small Business Administration. So we will walk those who are qualified for SBA microloans. I'll help them in a couple years to reach out to those places.
From there, Londigan says some of those small business owners will be able to move on to traditional bank loans because they'll meet the requirements they weren't able to before. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
A Fort Smith native is hoping to win big on the latest season of Project Runway, which premieres tonight on Bravo TV.
Amazing. Have you ever seen anything like this? Project Runway history.
This is a first.
This season on Project Runway.
This season, Brittany Allen will be one of the 16 fashion designers competing on the show. The Southside High School graduate got her bachelor's degree in apparel studies at the University of Arkansas before going on to get a master's degree in fashion design from the Savannah College of Art and Design in Georgia. Allen says without many opportunities for fashion industry experience in Arkansas, she felt her best option to get into that field was through education.
And then really, you know, kind of honing into my design aesthetic and what I wanted to do and really realizing that like, oh, I can be a fashion designer really anywhere. But, you know, it kind of forced me to really figure out what I wanted to do in life because there wasn't a whole lot of opportunities for me to go work with big designers and big companies here. And so it was like, all right, well, maybe my only option is to start my own brand and really start designing. And so, you know, it was kind of like that push that I needed.
Allen now lives in Austin, Texas, where she runs her own fashion line, which focuses on women's contemporary ready-to-wear apparel and aims to attract younger clients. Allen says her Southern roots play a big role in her designs, which she says, are a mix of Betsy Johnson and Dolly Parton.
Because Betsy Johnson, it's so fun and flirty, but it's yet powerful and feminine. But the Dolly Parton part of it is like, I'm still a Southern girl. No matter what, even if I was to try to move to LA or like New York, I'm gonna hate it. And, you know, I love to go visit, but like, I'll always be in the South. Like, the South is like where I'm supposed to be. And so, you know, even if it's just like the inspiration or imagery or whatever, like, I'm always looking at that whole like Southern component of my designs.
Allen says she's been tuning into Project Runway for more than a decade. During the course of the show, she and the other contestants are given a design challenge with a limited amount of time to complete it. Contestants who don't make the cut are eliminated. Allen says the most challenging aspect of being on Project Runway was the self-doubt.
And you're thinking, you know, oh, I got this. I can sew anything. And then you get into the workroom that very first day with 15 other people that also can sew anything. And they also have an identity. And so you're thinking, well, I just really have to be the best of the best. Oh my God, what have I done? How did I fool people into thinking that like I could do this? And then you just really have to like, the confidence has to be there. Like, you have to build yourself up to know like, I'm here for a reason and I just have to do me and hope that that really like comes out and shines and it's enough.
The winner receives $300,000, a feature in Elle magazine, and a mentorship with the Council of Fashion Designers of America. The show premieres tonight at 8:30 on Bravo.
Welcome to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. After a week away for Thanksgiving, we are back and ready to finish the year strong, as I'm sure you are too. Let's get to some of the headlines, starting at Northwest Arkansas Regional Airport, where officials are studying the possibility of attracting cargo operations to the airport. Cincinnati-based consulting firm Landrum & Brown will help determine whether XNA needs to invest time and resources into that endeavor as an additional potential revenue stream. Landrum & Brown should have that feasibility study completed sometime next spring. And the four largest cities in Northwest Arkansas reported a 14.5% gain in sales tax revenue in their November reports. That's the third time this year the cities have reported double-digit monthly gains compared to the prior year. Bentonville, Fayetteville, Rogers, and Springdale reported a combined sales tax revenue of $6.4 million in November. Bentonville led the way with revenue growth of 55% compared with November 2018 totals. Fayetteville reported the most November sales tax revenue at $1.96 million. For those stories and more, you can follow our reporting online each and every day. Just go to nwabusinessjournal.com. When we come back, we'll talk about the year that was in advanced energy with Arkansas Advanced Energy Association Executive Director Katie Niebaum. You're listening to the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. It's local banking with local commitment. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender.
Time now for a conversation with Katie Niebaum, who's the Executive Director of the Arkansas Advanced Energy Association. That is the advocacy group for advanced energy in Arkansas. Niebaum said 2019 was a good year from her perspective, and there is a growing demand for a variety of advanced energy resources, and that certainly includes technologies like solar energy. Here's more of our conversation now with Katie Niebaum.
These technologies are creating job opportunities, allowing businesses to invest in their local communities and really generate energy savings for customers. And I say customer, whether you're a homeowner, business, or school district, or university, that those customers are able to reinvest and work on for other priorities. So it's been an increasingly important economic driver in our state with tremendous opportunity ahead.
Yeah, let's talk about both of those sides that you mentioned. You know, first, on the residential side, do you continue to see more movement on just the adoption of residential solar energy? Just for me, it seems like I see more and more commercials from more companies that are offering that service.
Yes, and I would say in our Arkansas Advanced Energy Association membership overall, certainly we've seen strong growth within our solar companies, new companies starting up or coming into the state, but really our homegrown companies expanding, creating more jobs to try and meet that demand as more Arkansans come to find out about the benefits of solar. And it's certainly residential, but larger users too. And in fact, this past year, Arkansas recorded the largest annual increase in the number of what we call net metering systems, which most of those are solar systems. They're either, affixed on a roof or ground mounted. And we're right now at about close to 1,000 systems in the state, which is still a very small percentage of the overall number of ratepayers in the state. But there's been some real growth in the industry. Arkansas has been a late adopter, but we are now among the leading states for solar job growth. Only five states had a higher rate of growth than Arkansas. So there's a long runway ahead for us. There's some advantages for being a late adopter. Arkansans are able to take advantage of the technologies as costs have come down. And there's also been some good policies enacted as late as this year that has helped enable Arkansas to take advantage of solar and some other energy efficiency technologies.
And it seems, from my perspective, it seems like from the business side, the commercial side, we are reporting more frequently on municipal projects. We talk about adoption. It seems like municipalities and businesses are increasing their rate of adoption. What about large-scale projects by private business? Is that needle moving at all? What's it going to take to do that?
It is. And really, it's a wide range of from all segments that are recognizing, hey, this can help me meet my customer demand. In certain cases, businesses, customers might say, hey, it's really important to me if you are sourced from, a clean energy resource. So that's maybe one reason why a business might seek these clean energy resources. But, most of the businesses and other customers who are approaching our members, they're looking to cut costs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it is definitely an economic decision that's making sense to a lot of people. But why you are seeing so many municipalities, public entities taking advantage, it seems like there's been this wave this year. That's a result of legislation that passed earlier this year, what we call third-party solar leasing, which had overwhelming bipartisan support from state legislators. It took effect in July. And that's allowed these public entities, a school district, a city, or a county, to partner with a third-party solar provider and receive power that way. And one of the benefits for doing that is that private company can take advantage of a tax credit that's been offered at the federal level, whereas that public entity hasn't been able to do that. So the savings are passed along. So it's a beneficial structure agreement.
You mentioned there are a variety of ways and a variety of segments for alternative energy to be a cost savings. What about electric vehicles and electric vehicle adoption? Just kind of maybe what's your takeaway? Maybe it's just what are you seeing about consumer attitudes here in Arkansas about electric vehicles? Is that a needle that's moving at all?
I think you're going to continue to see adoption of electric vehicles across the state. Certainly the city of Fayetteville has been a leader, having charging stations among city infrastructure. Arkansas, the state of Arkansas will be offering Volkswagen settlement dollars through state programs that will help with the adoption of EV charging infrastructure. We'll see that throughout next year. And several of our Arkansas Advanced Energy Association members are now offering charging infrastructure as part of their services because they've seen demand from customers. So those are some good positive trends in the EV world.
That is Katie Niebaum with the Arkansas Advanced Energy Association. For more on their work, you can visit arkansasadvancedenergy.com. Coming up next week at nwabusinessjournal.com, you will find the digital version of the latest edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. 2020 is shaping up to be a big year for Class A office space in the region. Fayetteville broker David Erstein with CBRE has a new report with some analysis about that. Plus, Jeff De La Rosa has some reporting on some significant commercial real estate development going on along U.S. Highway 412 in Tawneytown. You can find those stories and much more in the next issue of the Business Journal. It'll be out next week, and you can read the digital version online at nwabusinessjournal.com. And that's all the time we have today for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and I am joined now by Leah Uribe, an associate professor of music at the University of Arkansas. Welcome back.
Hi, Antoinette. How are you doing?
Good. Did you have a good holiday?
I did. I ate too much, but also
as you should.
Encountered some good music.
Good. Well, what music do we have coming up this week?
All right. We have a wide variety of shows coming this week, and I'm excited to highlight all of them. So, starting with the University of Arkansas World Music Ensemble, directed by Professor Nicola Redden, and special guest mezzo-soprano Ismaelena Serrano and alumna Maja Sevo. They will be performing songs from Greece, Lebanon, Andalusia, Lisbon, Naples, Thessaloniki, and Jerusalem. This is going to happen at the Geisinger Music House, Roots Festival headquarters, downtown Fayetteville, on Saturday, December 7th at 7 p.m. This event is free and open to the public, and it's just a great opportunity to listen to an eclectic program from this ensemble that is actually a class at the music department, but then has evolved into something much, much more interesting, exploring world music traditions.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Also, on Saturday, December the 7th, Amos Cochran, which is one of our, you know, favorite Fayetteville bass composers, mm-hmm. Emmy-nominated musician, along with recording artist Kevin Black, will be presenting Air Structures, described by Amos as a hypnotic soundscape created with synthesizer, percussion, and computer-manipulated sounds that blur the boundaries of ambient, electronic, jazz, and classical music. So this event will take place at Phoenix Gallery, downtown Fayetteville, by the square, and it is a Trillium Salon Series-sponsored event. This is on Saturday, December 7th. Doors will open at 7:30 p.m., and the show will start at 8 p.m. Tickets are $10, and they include a copy of the artist's self-titled debut album, Air Structures. And tickets will be available at the door.
Nice. Music to take with you. Love it.
I know. That's exciting. A little present early Christmas.
Right? Yeah.
We also have some events at the University of Arkansas. So starting with the University Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Robert Mueller. For this concert, they are joining forces with the Bentonville High School Chamber Orchestra, directed by Jesse Collette. The University Symphony Orchestra is celebrating this season Beethoven's 250th birthday. And for this concert, they will be playing his Leonore Overture No. 3. Then the high school orchestra will be, Bentonville High School of Orchestra will be joining the University Symphony Orchestra in the Brahms Academic Festival Overture, and also they will be playing some of their own selections. This event is taking place at the Faulkner Performing Arts Center, University of Arkansas, Monday, December 9th at 7:30 p.m. As always, $10 general admission tickets, and also $5 for students, faculty, staff, and seniors. On the following day, same place, Faulkner Performing Arts Center, we have a Schola Cantorum conducted by Dr. Stephen Caldwell. It's going to be a really, really cute concert, open for families and kids that are especially encouraged to attend. They will be presenting their annual concert entitled A Child's Christmas in Wales. This traditional story written by Dylan Thomas will be narrated by our own professor, Henry Runkles, and the music has been arranged and written by the conductor, Dr. Caldwell, as he is completing a six-year commission project. This is a great concert to attend if you want to, you know, early start into the Christmas spirit.
Yes.
On Sunday, December the 8th, at 2 p.m. at the Walton Arts Center, we have the Boston Brass Holiday Music show. So this is a group that is known for their great music, boisterous fun, and lively repertoire with a touch of humor and personality. They will be performing audience favorite songs from their two holiday recordings, Christmas Bells and Swinging, and the Stinkin' Christmas Carols. Tickets are $15 to $25, and you can get them at the Walton Arts Center door or at the box office or by visiting waltonartscenter.org. On Tuesday, December 10th at 7:30 p.m., we have the Latin American Ensemble, University of Arkansas group, directed by Professor Fernando Valencia. And they will be playing their last concert of the season. And the title of this concert is Latin Music, Many Roots, Many Faces. And as always, they will be presenting musical traditions from countries of Latin America and also some Latin jazz. This concert is free and open to the public, Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall, Fine Arts Building, University of Arkansas, 7:30 p.m. And this is just a great ensemble that explores a wide range of styles and the richness of and diversity of the music of Latin America. Expect some styles like son, danzón, cha-cha-cha, mambo, and newer styles like salsa and timba. Be ready to dance as
well. So a little bit of a change from some holiday music. You want to toss in some flavor,
right?
Here.
And
yeah.
I think this is how we Latin American people celebrate Christmas.
Also.
So get into that as well.
Yes.
Yeah, that's part of the exercise. Besides all of these awesome events, as always at the University of Arkansas, we have almost every day a concert. So go to the webpage that we are publishing in our page, Authors at Large. And you'll find concerts for choir, saxophone, the University of Arkansas Children's Choir, a viola recital, a gospel chorale, anything you may want, you'll find it right there.
So many things. That's so fun, though.
So fun. So many options, and I hope everybody goes to everything.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anjanette.
Leah Uribe is an associate professor of music at the University of Arkansas.
Happy holidays from KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway, your chance to win a gift from one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include Theater Squared, the Dixon Street Bookshop, Apple Seeds, and others. Winners announced December 13th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. KUAF.com to register. Support comes from Clubhouse Fitness, helping Arkansas become a healthiest state through personal training, over 70 classes weekly, and access to outdoor activities, with two locations in Fayetteville, plus one in Little Rock. Club HAUSFitness.com for more.
Brown versus Board of Education was a monumental decision regarding school integration, but it didn't end conversations or experiences of segregation. Erica Wilson, Thomas Willis Lambeth Distinguished Chair in Public Policy at the University of North Carolina School of Law, researches and writes about public education and the composition of student populations. This fall, she spoke on the U of A campus as a visiting scholar. She discussed her article, Monopolizing Whiteness, and she also discussed that article with us. Among other examinations, it considers a pair of school districts in Alabama, Birmingham and Mountain Brook. The district's border, but Wilson says Mountain Brook's demographics are quite different than Birmingham's.
It's approximately 96% white and approximately 4% non-white. But probably even more jarring than the racial demographics or the socioeconomic demographics, I think, the percentage of students who qualify for free and reduced lunch, which is the measure of poverty that school districts use, is something like less than 6%. So not only is it predominantly white, it's also lacking in low-income students, has, I would say, middle, upper-middle class students is the predominant makeup of the student body.
How close is Mountain Brook to Birmingham?
It's depending on the outer edge, it's about five, somewhere between 4 and 5 miles. So it's really close, actually.
To an outsider, it would seem like it is Birmingham, probably.
Right, that's exactly right. And the interesting thing is that it's in Jefferson County, Alabama. And so Jefferson County has its own school district. So the city of Birmingham has its own school district, and so does Jefferson County. And so at some point, Mountain Brook used to be a part of the Jefferson County school system. And shortly after Brown versus Board of Education decided to engage in a municipal secession to remove itself from the county district.
And we're talking about Alabama now, but certainly this is not the only place in the United States or the United States South where this phenomenon exists.
That's exactly right. And so an important thing to understand is that the secessions are getting a lot of attention in the South, and that's mainly because the South has larger territorial bases over which their school districts tend to be drawn. So in the South, you're more likely to have county-based school districts. And so one of the peculiar reasons for this is because the South had Jim Crow laws on the book for schools. And so it was actually more efficient to duplicate schools at the county level versus the municipal level. And so that's one of the reasons why the districts in the South tend to be larger. The other reason is that in the aftermath of Brown, a number of school systems were required to consolidate in order to make integration easier. So I always like to remind people the South get somewhat of a bad rap, but the Northeast and the Midwest are actually the most racially segregated places. And so the Northeast and Midwest tend to have smaller school districts, so they have municipally-based school districts. So, for example, my husband is from New Jersey, and so in New Jersey, he lived in Englewood, New Jersey. And so Englewood has its own school district. Right next door is Teaneck, like literally probably less than a mile and a half apart are these very small, tiny school systems. And so to the extent the municipalities tend to be racially segregated, the school districts are as well. And so one of the things I always like to remind people who tend to give the South a hard time is that the school districts in the Northeast and Midwest don't have to secede because they are already drawn intentionally in some ways very myopically to preserve certain demographics in the districts.
So Teaneck and Englewood, they
yes.
had similar disparate
That's right.
Populations,
yes.
social, economic.
And so, in fact, it's interesting, in New Jersey, a lawsuit was recently filed making an argument that because of the stark segregation between school districts, the state should step in and do something in order to force the individual districts to integrate, that the state has authority for public education. And so it's the state's responsibility to make sure that the way that public education is delivered doesn't serve as a conduit for racial segregation by delivering it through municipally based districts.
What is lost for students in either district that you might have these wildly different populations?
Yeah. So I think a lot of attention is paid to what's lost for students of color. We know that in districts that are predominantly minority, you're more likely to have a higher percentage of low-income students. And so the things that come along with that are the structural barriers of poverty that make it difficult for children to learn. Food insecurity, for example, housing insecurity, the need for a more holistic set of inputs in order to effectively educate the children. We also know that districts that are predominantly low-income, predominantly students of color, actually have a harder time drawing high-quality teachers, the most highly qualified teachers. And those teachers are a really important component in terms of delivering a quality education. But one thing I've started to write about more recently is what's lost for white students, because I think it's lost in the discussion about segregation in schools, what it means for white students to be racially segregated. And so, in fact, across the country, white students are the most racially segregated demographic. We never think about it in those terms because a lot of the discussion in Brown versus Board of Education, for example, talked about the harms to students of color of being racially segregated. But what a lot of people don't know is in the same social science briefing that the court relied on to reach its decision in Brown, some social scientists also talked about the harms to white students of being racially segregated. And some of those harms include a tendency to lean more towards authoritarianism, to accept authority unquestioningly, to have an inflated sense of their superiority and the inferiority of students of color. And probably most compelling is the internal conflict that might exist in terms of their understanding of the rules of democracy and how it ends up that they are afforded more opportunities and privileges than students of color. So one of the other things that is lost for white students who are racially segregated is they miss out on the actual educational benefits of being in a racially diverse school setting. So they miss out on more more robust exchanges in terms of conversations, in terms of exposure. And so some researchers have actually started to make connections between racially segregated school systems and things like police killings, because to the extent that white students are not exposed to other people, it tends to allow them to or create a sense of superiority and inferiority and dehumanizes people of color for white students. And so I think it's really important that we concentrate on not just students of color, but white students as well when we think about the harms.
Well, it sounds like it's much bigger an us problem, right? I mean...
Yes, no, that's exactly right. It is an us problem. And so in a recent article that I'm working on, I've actually started to talk about white student segregation as a form of monopolization of high-quality education. And so I make arguments that when you have a school district like Mountain Brook that aggregates predominantly white, predominantly affluent middle-class students in one district, a lot of the educational inputs that are needed to create high-quality schools flow exclusively to that district to the detriment of the more racially diverse districts around it. And so it matters because it creates regional disparities in terms of the quality of education that workers in a region, let's say, have. I think we've seen instances where in some places where they don't have high-quality education, where they do have more racially segregated, economically segregated school districts, they have a lower or smaller worker base from which to draw upon and makes it harder to recruit businesses to come into areas, et cetera.
These are systemic problems. I mean, we've gone through generations mm-hmm. with this. Are there legal avenues? I mean, you can look at Boston, you can look at Little Rock, you can look at Chicago and Alabama and probably every state in the union, you can find that there is pushback whenever. Mm-hmm. But are there legal avenues to try to better diversify school districts?
Yes. So one of the important things to understand is that the state in our system of federalism has primary responsibility for public education. So and every state in the union has a right to education clause in its state constitution. And so one of the things as a matter of law that states can do is to structure the provision of public education in ways that makes it harder for particularly white parents, I would say, to racially segregate. And so we've seen in the South when aggressive efforts were made to integrate schools that it actually worked for some period of time. And the reason it worked is because the state made flight harder. So when you set up structures that make flight harder, like having county-based school districts, for example, it makes it more costly for white parents in particular to flee somewhere else to avoid racially integrated schools. So one of the things that we could do as a matter of law is really closely examine how we're delivering public education, how we are drawing school district boundary lines, how we're drawing attendance zone boundary lines. And so that's a concrete thing as a matter of law that we can do. I think it really is, the research has shown that the more costly you make it to flee, the more likely you are to have racially integrated schools. And so in my current home state, North Carolina, we saw that with Charlotte-Mecklenburg. They had, and Wake County as well, they had years, decades of success in terms of racially integrating their school systems. And it turned out that white parents found this is good for my kids too. And so they enjoyed it. Eventually, the diversity was dismantled as they moved back to neighborhood schools, as they were released from federal court supervision, which is really a shame. But we do have concrete evidence of things that work, including reconsidering the way that we deliver public education. But if there's one thing that I would probably emphasize the most is that racial segregation in schools is a choice. And so the state, of course, can put structures in place to make it harder to for parents to choose racially segregated schools. But the number one reason why schools are segregated is because parents, particularly white parents, I would say, make the choice for them to be. Much of our policies and laws around school desegregation have focused on convincing white parents not to flee, whether it's through magnet schools, whether it's through busing, et cetera. It's been a focal point is convincing white parents not to flee. And so that's why I think it's really, really important for people like myself who write on this issue or talk about this issue to emphasize that this is an us problem, as you alluded to earlier, and that white students do get valuable experience and benefits from being in racially integrated schools, and there are harms to white students of being racially segregated. So the more that we can conceptualize this as an us problem and not a they or them problem, I think the more likely we are to, not just as a matter of law, but as a matter of citizens, fashion remedies that work to racially integrate the schools.
Okay, is there a problem? This goes perhaps more sociological than legal, but is there a problem if you have had a couple of generations of students who grew up in more or less affluent, majority white or almost entirely white affluent schools, and you get that sort of superiority, and then they become parents, and so they might think this way or tend to think this way, so they want their children to be in schools like that, and then they become parents? I mean, you got to break this cycle, right?
Right. That's absolutely right. I think a big part of it is that we tend to do what we know. And so to
we're
the
human beings, right? Yeah.
Right. Exactly. To the extent that someone has gone to a school that is predominantly white, predominantly affluent, they may want the same thing for their kids. The other factor there is I think that we have to remove the negative stigma that is associated with students of color. There's research that shows that no matter the quality of the school, that if a school is seen as predominantly black or predominantly Latino, it's automatically perceived as a bad school. And so one example I like to give is in Riverside, California, there was a huge debate over naming a high school that had a predominantly white student body, naming that high school Martin Luther King Jr. High School. And so the parents really revolted and went kicking and screaming. And a lot of the rationale for it was that colleges would perceive the school to be predominantly black based on the name, and that would lessen their children's chance of getting into a college because there would be perceptions that they received a lower quality education. So it's very challenging. I mean, I think the desire for many white parents to put their children in predominantly white schools is something that I think all parents want what's perceived as the best for their children. So to the extent that students of color, the inclusion of students of color in schools is perceived as lowering the quality of the school, it will be a forever problem that we can't solve until we tackle that very important one.
Erica Wilson is Thomas Willis Lambeth Distinguished Chair in Public Policy at the University of North Carolina School of Law. She was in Fayetteville to speak on the University of Arkansas campus as a visiting scholar.
Support comes from Archon Plus, providing digital and offset printing, graphic design, promotional items, and a variety of business services. Located just off College Avenue at 461 East Township in Fayetteville, Archon has been locally owned and operated for over 30 years. Printing NWA.com or 444-7711 for more. Families caring for a loved one at the end of life don't have to face it alone. Circle of Life Hospice has been offering compassionate care for patients and families for over 25 years. End-of-life care from a professional hospice team is available with little to no out-of-pocket expense. 800-495-5511 or nwacircleoflife.org for more.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Figure 5. Contributors today included Jacqueline Froelich, Antoinette Grajeda, and Zuzana Sitek. Zuzana also provided information about Project Runway contestant Brittany Allen. Timothy Dennis mastered our show from the Herald and Blanchcock News Studio. Big, big thank yous to Antoinette Grajeda for producing and putting together last night's Ozarks at Large Christmas show at the Fayetteville Public Library, and to Timothy Dennis for recording the performances so we can share them with you on Christmas Eve. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. We will be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your Thursday.